When little bears first show a will to compete, it's hard for parents not to jump in with both feet.
Wow, you nailed that the first time.
Well, you know, I was born for the stage. What can I say?
Welcome back to Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast. I'm your host, Phil Gonzalez, and today we are doing The Berenstain Bears Go Out for the Team from 1986. This is a book. Let me explain something. I have a lot of guests on the show, and I tend to have people on who are more or less experts in their field. But I'll say that, like, when I have a person on, be it a doctor, be it a dentist, be it a camp director, be it a person who is an expert in manners, I generally feel like there's some sort of touchstone there, something that I can relate to and bring to the table. But I got to this book and I was stymied because it's covering a subject that, well, I feel like even with a doctor, I understand kind of what's going on because I have a body and things have gone wrong with it. And so I understand that a doctor comes in and they do things to the body that makes it better, that makes it feel good. But this book is about a topic that I am just kind of completely ignorant on, despite the fact that I have lived both in Texas and in Minnesota, states that take this topic somewhat seriously. That subject is sports. And to that end, I have brought on a guest who I feel knows a thing or two about sports. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Mr. David Kalin. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
Now, am I right in assuming that you do know a thing or two about sports?
I would venture to say that I actually know a thing or three.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, maybe even a higher number. I don't know what the highest number you can think of is. It's probably not that high, but I know a little bit.
So I'm not one of those people who doesn't know anything about sports, but also like makes a lot of like sports ball jokes. Like,
yeah, those never get old, by the way. Those are great.
It's one of those topics that in recent years, I would say, like, people have really reveled in the fact that they don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I'd say that I would say that there's certainly I was talking to somebody recently about how I think that kind of and there's nothing wrong about any of this, but the internet has made it very easy for people that were originally kind of in the shadows socially to find like-minded people that they can communicate about things that they were interested in. But I think that for a long time, because sports are pretty deeply embedded in culture in America, if you weren't interested in them, you didn't really talk about it much.
And it probably has to do with the fact that, like, professional sports especially, it's so monolithic that if you weren't interested in it, it was really hard to escape. And now that geekier things have risen in, and I'm not saying that sports isn't a geeky thing because it totally can be. Now that, like, the things that were traditionally kept way underground have risen in the public esteem, I think it has given people who were not interested in sports to feel like they had the authority to speak out about how they felt for so many years being bombarded by something they weren't interested in.
Yeah, I would say that there's certainly truth to that. But you, you know, made a very valid point in that being geeky and being interested in sports can, and more often than not nowadays, is certainly a kind of an increasing trend. I mean, most professional sports teams now have analytics departments that break down very complex statistics that, you know, do regression analysis to try and you know, put together the best team they can. And, you know, you see people that have degrees from MIT being involved in putting together a sports franchise as opposed to some guy who worked his way up as a scout. But that said, I don't really know how Bears feel about sports, or at least I didn't until I read this book.
Well, I would like to know why you are considered such an expert on this subject.
I think it largely has to do with the fact that when I was 8, I slept with a bunch of sports books underneath my pillow. That's a true story.
Yeah.
And I assume that I absorbed all the information by osmosis. So that's all in my brain now. And I am not shy and I'm kind of obnoxious.
About your sports knowledge?
Yeah, well, about everything, but sports knowledge is a lot. So I think after a while, it wasn't very difficult for that to permeate most conversations that I had, to the point that now it's actually kind of difficult to make it clear to people that I have other interests, which I do. I mean, I'm very into politics. I was actually a film minor in college. But I have a tendency to steer conversation to, you know, the Mets a little too often. So that kind of would do it.
Well, and also, I mean, like, it's not a negative to be identified as an expert in something. It's
No, I wouldn't think so.
And I don't think that you come by your reputation falsely, because you do seem to know quite a bit about the subject. Now, you said this goes back to your childhood. Like, see, to me, as a kid, I didn't do sports. My sister was the swimmer. She was the soccer player. She was the one who got outside and got dirty and ran around in a field. I was the one who stayed at home and watched television. Were you athletic as a kid?
You know, I played football for 9 years as a kid. I started when I was 8, and I was on my high school football team through senior year. Unfortunately for me, by the time I was a senior, puberty had kind of caught up with me, and I was much smaller than everybody else playing. But, I played all the normal sports that most kids play when they're kids. I think soccer, baseball, and football, I think, are the only ones I actually played in an organized fashion. But, I mean, I played street hockey with friends or basketball with friends. And I, in high school, when it wasn't football season, my friends and I would play Ultimate Frisbee pretty regularly, which is a much more exhausting and intensive sport than I think people give it credit for.
So you did grow up though with sports being a part of childhood. Like, that's a familiar concept to you.
Yes. I don't think it really was until I was about 8 or 9, but I think, what I tell people is that one time I walked into my parents' room and saw my dad watching a Monday night football game. It must've been in 1992 or 93, between the Browns and the Broncos. And I think I just got kind of entranced. And, from that point on, I got kind of obsessed with it, to the point that now I probably know too much about the topic.
And, you know, I have a podcast about the Berenstain Bears, so I honestly don't believe it's possible to know too much about a topic. Like, I literally talk about these books every single week.
That is a valid point that you make. Yes.
Well, you grew up with baseball, football, and soccer. And I know a couple of Cubs who also grew up with baseball, football, and soccer. And we read a book about them.
Yes, we did. Oh, boy. Did we ever.
And so in this book, The Berenstain Bears Go Out for the Team, we learn a lot about brother and sister bear and their sport habits.
Yes. I one thing that I was curious about when I read this, and, you know, I read the Berenstain Bears books when I was a kid. But I can't imagine that I read one of them past the age of maybe 9, or maybe even younger than that. I honestly, it's hard for me to tell what age they're appropriate for. But is there like a running thing where sister bear is better than brother bear at everything?
In the Berenstain Bears, No Girls Allowed, it was established that sister bear, as she's gotten older, has gotten better at many sports and games than brother and his friends are. And you sort of get the idea throughout the book series that they're about on equal footing when it comes to physical ability.
All right. Because in this book, she seems to pretty much outplay him in everything.
Yeah.
I don't want to say impressive, because I think that implies that a woman would inherently be less athletic than a man, which is wrong. But it did seem kind of surprising.
Yeah, it's an impressive portrayal, especially for the era it came out of.
Yes. Yeah, because I think that, even through the 80s, we still very much had concepts of defined gender roles that, to a certain degree, this breaks through a little bit. And it even brings up sexism at one point, which I was pretty surprised by. It seemed like a bit of a complex topic for a children's book.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, the Berenstains themselves, like, as much as, like, the Berenstain Bear family is sort of traditional, with Mama sort of being at home and Papa being the worker, it does, like, Stan and Jan were kind of always trying to push against those norms as much as they could. I mean, they were a non-traditional couple. I mean, they were both artists. They had this, like, life where they were on equal footing as creators. And I think they were constantly trying to put that into their books. Mm. So you see brother and sister, like, throwing the football back and forth and kicking the soccer ball back and forth.
Yeah, no, they're competing throughout the whole thing with each other, but, it always seems to be on equal footing.
Oh, yeah.
Or Sister Bear has the advantage, which...
Now, do these seasons line up? I don't know anything about this, so...
Well, so they do more or less. You know, football is played in the fall time. Soccer actually generally runs – well, the MLS, which is the American Soccer League, runs over the summer. But that's largely an attempt to avoid having to go up against the NFL or mm-hmm. the NBA or, you know, Major League Baseball is the only other sport running at that time. And it's also an attempt to try and get European soccer players to maybe moonlight in the U.S. for an extra payday in the off season. But it's not so surprising to me that they might associate soccer with the fall here. But it really professionally runs basically all time other than the summertime during the course of the year. But football, they're right on with. Hockey happens generally, we associate it with the winter because you have to have ice to play it. The NHL runs from early October until, I mean, the Stanley Cup final is currently happening right now. We're recording this in mid-June to give you some idea. Although there was one thing I thought very funny about that is they say that they play basketball and ice hockey in the winter. And there's a shot of Brother Bear hitting a jumper over Sister Bear, but the hoop and the backboard have icicles on it.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And
like they're literally playing it in the dead of winter.
Yes, and while basketball season is the wintertime, if you're in like a high school league or the NBA, they play it indoors.
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought it was a little crazy to think that these bears, while barefoot, mind you.
Exactly.
Would be playing in, I guess, their icy driveway in sub-zero temperatures. It must be below freezing because there are icicles.
There's icicles. I'm going to guess they had to have, like, salted the driveway, like, really just scraped it up. Maybe that's just part of the game, like you – or maybe their feet are better equipped for it, but then the ball would be just all over the place.
Yeah, no, the ball would have a lot harder time. If you want to go deep into the physics of this, which I'm sure you do, you know, the cold air being denser – would make it much harder for the ball to bounce off of frozen concrete, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm looking at it, and I'm like, well, maybe in bear country, maybe basketball isn't the same sport we have. Like, maybe they don't dribble the ball, and maybe they're playing with, like, a heavy medicine ball. Like,
I think that on one hand, I would say that there might be some, you know, plausibility to that, but I'm going to disagree with you for this reason only.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout this book, there are several times where Sister Bear points out relatively obscure baseball rules and is correct. And that leads me to believe that not only do they play with the same rules that humans do in their world, but they are sticklers about them.
Well, you got me on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know. But my belief is that they probably play with the same rules. But hey, maybe they just like being out in the cold more than we do. I don't know.
They probably do. And so their favorite sport is baseball. It says it right there in big, bold letters. And they really take it seriously.
Oh, yeah. Way more seriously than I think most children do.
Yeah, this is a casual game for them. And yet they're out there. They literally practice the game.
Yeah. They're practicing, you know, grounders and they, you know, there's a scene where Sister Bear is reading the rule book, which is something I never even glanced at until I was an umpire for Little Leaguers when I was 15. And I think that was the first time I ever actually opened a rule book to baseball. Otherwise, you know, you just kind of assume. But there,
and you know it's the rule book because it's just titled.
Oh, it says rule book. Yeah. No, there is no arguing that.
Yep.
You can't get around it.
Now they're practicing pitch. They're pitching and catching. They're practicing their batting. And it says that they're limbering up for the season, but it's soon made clear that this season is just let's hang out with our friends and play baseball. They're not on a team or anything.
Right. Yeah. No, they're, you know, I guess that is a strange notion because, you know, you have with professional baseball. Or even if you're playing on an organized team in a high school or in Little League, you know, there's a couple of weeks where you practice to train and get in shape. And it seems kind of silly to me that they would work hard to get in shape for baseball season when it was just, you know, playing in the sandlot in Farmer Ben's, you know, meadow with their buddies. But, you know, everything else we see indicates that Sister Bear and Brother Bear are pretty competitive. So I guess they want to make sure that even if it's just a pickup game, you know, they used to say that Michael Jordan was so competitive that he cheated at, you know, gin rummy with his grandmother, I think. So,
well, I think you raised an interesting point because the Bears are throughout the series, they are portrayed as like the Cubs, at least, as very competitive, not in a a negative way, not in a like an over competitive way, sometimes a little bit, if that's the point of the book. But I think that it paints a picture of brother and sister as dedicated to their interests.
Yes,
like they're gonna succeed because they take what they love seriously.
Yes, I think that's part of the lesson that the books are trying. I assume are part of the lesson that the books are trying to impart is
right.
That if you're going to take on a challenge, you should dedicate yourself to that challenge. And if it's worth doing, it's worth doing well, I suppose.
And I think that's good advice for a little kid who's interested in getting into sports. That it's something that the kids who dedicate themselves to it outside of practice, who think about the game, who make it a little bit more of their life, might have a better chance of getting further in it than the more casual players.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially these days, there's almost a monetization of youth athletic training that's kind of shameful. But, a lot of the kids that are better at baseball or football, they'll, in the off season, they go to camps where they can learn from minor league or major league instructors and be trained in the nuances of the game. And part of that has to do with, if you really want to make yourself a better player, or if you really want to understand the game better, you'll take those extra steps to hone those skills. And that's not just about sports. I mean, that's something that is that's applicable in pretty much anything.
Oh, indeed. And right now, the only thing that's driving these kids is the passion in their hearts, like the love of the game. Because they're playing out on Farmer Ben's field. It's a makeshift baseball diamond.
Yes. They only mention that the second base is a rock.
Uh-huh.
And they, they have some ground rules, which I find interesting. And I can get into those in a second because they'll be of interest to no one but me. But I still found it interesting.
Oh, please go into them.
Oh, okay. But, they mention that second base is a rock, but they don't mention that third base is a log, and home plate appears to be, a garbage can cover. And to a certain degree, there's actually some truth to that. I mean, when you have kids that get together to play any sport, if it's just on an open green pasture, you know, there's some truth to that. When kids are putting together a field for a sporting event, sometimes they just kind of take whatever odds and ends are around them to, outline the playing field.
Well, they've certainly done that here. And I think it's a good rule they have about not sliding into second base.
Because it's a rock.
Because it's a giant rock. Like, it's a huge, it's an enormous rock. I would think that at some point, if they kept going back to this field enough to actually wear a diamond into it, they could have found something softer to replace it with. But
you would think so.
And maybe Farmer Ben was like, don't dig anything out of my field.
You would think they could have come up with something better, but you know what? I don't judge.
Well, besides the second base, says any ball that was hit into the duck pond in left field was a ground rule double.
Yeah, so that I had some issues with.
Yeah, what does that mean? What's the issue with that?
So, all right. So when they say ground rules, what they're referring to is that every single baseball stadium has ground rules. And that's because baseball stadiums outside of the diamond, which is the base paths and the pitching mound, it doesn't have to be uniform. There are certain rules, like the outfield has to be a certain amount of distance from home plate, the outfield walls. But they don't all have to be the exact same specifications. If you look at football, basketball, hockey, soccer, those are all clearly defined in terms of what the rules and outlines of the playing field are. Baseball is different. And so because of that, every single stadium has to have its own ground rules regarding if the ball lands here, it means this. If it goes here, it means that. You know, give an example of that is that the Tampa Bay Rays play in a dome in St. Petersburg, Florida, that has these circular catwalks near the roof that are for, employees to walk along to change light bulbs or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if the ball hits those catwalks, then there is a ground rule stating whether or not it's an out or a hit. You know, I'll be honest, I actually don't know what it is offhand. But that's what ground rules refers to. Now, in most stadiums, a ground rule double kind of generically refers to when you hit a baseball and it lands in the field of play, but then bounces over the outfield wall.
Okay.
Okay. So if it cleared the outfield while on the fly, it'd be a home run, assuming it's in fair territory and not foul territory. But when you hit a ball and it bounces in front of the wall and then goes over, they usually rule that a ground rule double. Here's my problem with that. She hits the ball into the duck pond, Sister Bear does.
Yeah.
And she gets a ground rule double. But when you look at the picture, she clearly gets it into the pond on the fly. And it's a fair distance from home plate. I don't know why that's not a home run. That would be my issue. But hey, you know what? It wasn't my field. I don't want to be too judgmental, and I'm certainly overthinking it. So
No. That's the point of this. So when it's a ground rule double, explain to our audience what that means, what a double is.
What that means is a double is when a player gets a hit and they get to second base. I mean, you hit at home plate, there's first base, second base, third base, and then there's home plate again. When you get all the way around, you score, and that's a run. If you get a double, that means that you got a long hit that you were able to get into second base with. When you have a ground rule double, once the ball leaves the field of play, play stops, everything's dead, you're automatically granted second base, and then any runner who is already on base gets to advance two bases. So let's say you had a runner on first base, he automatically goes to third.
So that's pretty advantageous.
Yes, it is. Although sometimes it actually can be less advantageous in the majors. You know, if you have a very fast guy on first base and the batter hits a ground rule double, that guy is limited to going to third. But if he was fast enough, maybe he would have scored.
Well, there's another thing where Cousin Freddy forgets to touch second base.
Yes.
He jumps over the rock. I don't blame him for jumping over the rock.
Right.
Again, they're barefoot and it's a rock.
It looks painful.
Yeah.
I know bears are outside all the time. Maybe they have tougher calluses on the bottom of their feet than we do. But I would imagine it kind of hurting to step on that base. But if that's the rule, that's the rule. And here's another thing where I thought that they really went into some more complicated and nuanced rules than you would think. So what Sister Bear does in this scene is what it would technically be called is appealing. She's appealing at second base because when you round the bases, when you are safe at first or second or third, or if you score, you have to touch every single base along the way. If you don't touch the base and then they throw the ball to that base, if you've passed it already, you're out.
Yeah.
And that's called appealing. And sometimes you'll see that if somebody hits a home run and they trot around the bases and they might be absent-minded and miss third base, let's say. And after they score, the team that's in the field at that time might appeal the call by having the pitcher throw to the third baseman who will then step on the bag or the base. Usually this amounts to nothing because half the time the umpire is not looking, so he can't really tell. And most of the time the guys do make sure to touch the base. Probably about 99.9% of the time it happens. But every once in a while when you appeal to third base or first base or whatever, you'll get the call. They'll call the guy out. But again, this is very obscure.
So if you hit a home run, even if you hit a home run and it's gone,
yes,
you can still get out if you miss that base.
Exactly. And Sister Bear makes a point to notice that Cousin Freddy did not touch second base, and therefore he's out. And there are a couple of instances where this has played into baseball. There's a very famous incident from 1908 when the New York Giants and the Chicago Cubs had one of the greatest pennant races of all time. And it basically came down to this one play in a game in September that is now called Merkel's Boner. But it basically revolves around a player named Merkel forgetting to touch second base. Also, when Mark McGwire broke the single-season home run record in 1998, on the home run where he broke Roger Maris's record, there's a very funny moment where he actually runs past first base in his celebration without touching it, and the first base coach kind of yells at him. He's like, hey, you got to come back and touch it. And he starts laughing, and he steps on the base and then comes all the way around.
And Cousin and Farmer Ben seems to agree. Farmer Ben's hip to the rules, too.
Oh, yeah. Hey, he's said it, so you know, he says right as rain. He's a wise, savvy guy who just enjoys watching some young Cubs play the game. And, you know, he wants to make sure that they know the rules just as well as he does, I guess.
I guess you could say that the Bears just take game rules very seriously.
Yes.
Like as a community.
Like I said earlier, they are sticklers. It goes down back to, hey, if you want to do something, you may as well do it right and do it well. You may as well know the rules, I think, is what they're trying to say.
So then the Bears fall victim to that thing that happens where a goat eats your ball.
Yes, it happens all the time, let me tell you. I actually, when I read this part, my first thought was that this might, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't, but it might have been the inspiration for the major climactic sequence in the movie The Sandlot, which, you know, I don't know when the last time you saw that was, but it's about a bunch of kids who spend the summer playing baseball. And one player steals his stepfather's baseball that's been autographed by Babe Ruth because he does not know who Babe Ruth is. And in the process of playing it, they hit a home run into the neighbor's yard where a giant dog named the Beast basically chews the thing up and ruins it. And a lot of the movie revolves around them trying to get this baseball back. But I assume that the people who wrote the script for that movie must have read a lot of Berenstain Bears in the process.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. I'm sure that it was probably on the tip of the Stan and Jan Berenstain's pen to make this baseball autographed by someone named perhaps Babe Ruth, as the naming convention of Bear Country goes. But the goat chewing and eating the cover of the baseball is like the catalyst for the major action in this, which is that Papa Bear is like, you know what? It's probably about time you guys joined a real team. And there's going to be tryouts for the Bear Country Cub League coming up. You want to go over and take a look and see if this is something you're interested in. So they drive over and take a look at the legit field. And it looks pretty nice.
It's like Xanadu, that type of thing.
Compared to their dirt patch.
There are no rocks instead of bases, which is pretty sweet. You know, that's the kind of luxury that most kids don't get. Their actual benches. All joking aside, it looks like a pretty nice baseball field.
It really is. And it's a co-ed league. It's a boy and girl Cubs.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I don't know if it's necessarily uniform around the country, but I know that my my little league that I played in, I've never played minor league baseball. I'm not that good. but when I played little league as a kid, you know, I started playing little league, I think when I was 9 or 10. But that was also a unisex league, and it didn't become men only until you got to high school, at which point the boys played baseball and the women played softball. And I believe softball was considered a female equivalent under Title IX, even though the sports are actually the general principles are the same, but they have a lot of differences.
Well, so the Cubs are very excited about trying out. And so they start practicing, which is funny because they were already practicing. Like,
yes,
they just crank things up. And it's Mama. And this is also something that sort of runs throughout the series. Mama is the sport expert. She's the one who actually knows how to coach the games.
Yeah, the impression I get is that Papa Bear is just kind of, you know, because he's earlier when they ask them how the game went and they tell them about the baseball, he's just kind of lying in the hammock while Mama Bear is, it looks like, maybe raking the yard. And then later on, she shows them how to choke up on the bat, which is, I won't say a complex thing because most players learn how to do that pretty early on, but it still seems like they're playing with the gender politics in this in a fascinating way.
So what is choking up on the bat? Please explain that.
Okay, so when you hold a baseball bat, you have your two hands near the nub at the end. And when you choke up on the bat, that means that you move your hands higher up on the bat. And when you hold the bat higher up, you can generate less power because a baseball bat is like a lever, right? If you look at it in physics, and what you're doing is you're using your hands and your wrists as the fulcrum to kind of power through the bat through the, they call it the hitting zone. But essentially when it hits the baseball, you're trying to create force by swinging that bat around the fulcrum. And the further down your hands are, closer to the nub, the more force that can generate. But at the same time, you lose control of the end of that bat. So when you choke up on the bat, you're losing some force, but it also allows you better control of the bat and where it is. So when you choke up on the bat, this is generally a thing that a player will do when he has two strikes against him in the batter's box, because you may not get a hit, but you can control the bat well enough that you can continue to foul off pitches. And when you foul, a foul ball is considered a strike, but you can't strike out on a foul ball. So unless it's a bunt, but that's another thing altogether.
So it's something that you would do if you had already gotten two strikes.
And you're trying to keep yourself trying to stay in the at-bat. There are other strategic times where you might choke up on the bat, too. Like, say it's a tie game in the bottom of the ninth and the winning run is on third and you don't want to hit a long fly ball because it might get out if there are two outs. You might choke up on the bat because then you might be able to get kind of a short half swing that just powers the ball past the infielders and gets a base hit. But, you know, now we're getting a little too nuanced. But choking up on the bat is something that you wouldn't necessarily do most of the time, but it is an important skill.
It's funny, I don't think
learn.
You can get too nuanced with these kids. I think that they are down for anything. Like, they are and one thing I think that this does shows is it shows that Stan and Jan had some knowledge of this. Like, this isn't something that they casually approach. These are either people whose kids played baseball or who played baseball themselves. Like, there's a history here.
Yes, but they also, you know, anybody who has played youth sports or watched somebody play youth sports has seen the parents that take it too mm-hmm. seriously. You know, there's a story I'll tell later on that part of this book reminded me of regarding that. But, you know, there are a lot of parents out there who kind of will put pressure on their children to succeed, whether it's because they want their kids to do well or if it's because they have their own misplaced lost glory that they're trying to recreate. But the better way to go about it, even if you know about the sport when your kids are interested in it, is to kind of let them decide for themselves how to figure out how seriously they want to take it. And you can help them with it, obviously, which Mama and Papa Bear do. But the sister and brother bear show a keen interest on their own. It's not forced on them.
Right. No, I think that's important. They showed that these kids were going to work hard anyway.
Yes.
And that they were just lucky to have someone like Mama around who knows the game as well as they do. She does say, you know, it's okay. It's only a game. If you don't make it, you can try out again next year. And this brings up the questionably sexist remark, because
yes.
Brother says that it's not the worst thing that can happen is if Sis makes the team and I don't. And she accuses him of making a sexist remark. And Mama says it's not really a sexist remark because
he's old.
She seems to be interpreting it as Brother's more concerned about the fact that this is something he's been trying for a lot longer.
Yes. To a certain degree, I can see both sides of that coin, naturally.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, the impression I get is that Brother Bear is not necessarily trying to be sexist so much as it is, you know, a natural competition between siblings. You know, I have a brother and a sister, and mm-hmm. My brother and I are occasionally competitive. And my sister and I have been competitive over things in the past. I don't think that's a gender thing necessarily. I think it's just about the fact that siblings spend so much time together. And the thing about siblings too, and I love my brother and my sister, but I don't think you really realize how much your relationship with them means to you until you're grown up. When you're younger, yeah. This is just some other person close to me in age that lives in the same home. And, you know, familiarity breeds contempt to a certain extent. You always want to do better than your sibling at whatever it is, regardless of age, regardless of sex. It doesn't matter. So I don't think he's being sexist in this particular instance. I think it's just that he's older and it's embarrassing when your, you know, baby sister might be better at baseball than you are.
Yeah. Well, let's barrel through this because we got a little ways to go.
Yeah.
And there's some interesting stuff that happens. They go to the tryouts and there are officials everywhere.
Yes.
With clipboards and sunglasses so you couldn't see what they were thinking. And it does look like a bunch of secret agents, like, milling about.
Yeah, this looks like all the clones of Agent Smith in The Matrix or something.
Yeah, it's intense. Like, there's a ton of little kids, and there's faceless bears with sunglasses just keeping track of every... They take this very seriously.
Okay.
This is a part where I'm like, okay, this community is very, very activity-oriented.
Yes. Now, when I played Little League, there were definitely tryouts. Now, the way that our Little League was organized is there were six chains, and each of those chains had teams at different levels. And when you were on the first level, you played against the first level team in the other chains. So you randomly were placed on a chain, and then you had tryouts. But the thing is, with Little League, no one got cut completely. You know, everybody was placed on some level. But at the same time, those tryouts did, to a certain degree, have kind of that competitive aspect to them where some of the parents took it very and possibly too seriously.
Yeah, I don't even see any parents around. This is – in this story, they keep it to the kids. Like, it's the kids and the officials.
Yes. Well, you know, in most little leagues, the officials are usually parents of
Oh, I guess that's true.
Kids, which I don't know if this league is supposed to be that way or if it isn't, or if the Berensteins just didn't think about it that in depth before they.
Yeah, because it looks to me like they brought in some outside help.
Yes. Now, there are people who, if it's an older level team or if it's a traveling team, there are some people who are not necessarily parents of players on the team, but are hired by the town to coach those groups. And I want to say this, you know, at first I thought this might be a traveling team since they actually cut kids, you know, like yeah. Some of them don't make the team. But later on, we'll find out that it's that there's a league with four different teams within the town. So I found a lot of this kind of strange, a little confusing, and maybe way more pressurized than it should be for kids or Cubs, sorry, of you know, this type of age.
We can see that it gets pressure. There's pressure because sister and brother initially start out kind of screwing up. She misses a ball and she misses a ground ball, and he swings too hard and he misses a ball and falls down on his pants. But then later on, he does the choking up on the bat thing that he was shown. Mm-hmm. Says he hits a good single and went to second base, and the fielder bobbled the ball. Says that sister fielded some grounders well, and once when she was batting, the catcher dropped the third strike, and she ran to first base, even though she had struck out. So that's a thing you can do, eh?
Yeah, this is the third or fourth time in this story that they bring up rules that aren't, they're not obscure, but they're definitely more nuanced than you would expect a young child to know. So, you know, if you strike out, you're out. But if you strike out swinging on a third strike, and the catcher drops the ball, they have to tag you or throw it to first base to get you out, you know, and most players won't even bother trying because when the catcher drops the ball, he drops it and it's right in his lap and there's no point. But if you swing at a third strike and the ball gets past the catcher and rolls to the backstop, you can run to first base, and that happens, you know, and there, I think there's very few instances, but there are times when a pitcher, because of this quirk, will end up striking out four batters in an inning, even though you can only have three outs, which it's only happened a handful of times, but I might be wrong about this, but I want to say that I think it was Chuck Finley may have done it twice. He was a pitcher for the Angels and several other teams for a while in the 1990s. But I know I'm getting off topic when I go there, but the fact that she got to first base on a drop third strike is a pretty obscure rule for a child to know or a Cub to know. And the, you know, as it says in the book, there was a big fuss, but the official was watching and she was right. But I think this is kind of maybe a more nuanced attempt to hit back on this idea of paying attention to all the rules and knowing all the ins and outs of anything that you do.
Right. And From a character development standpoint, I'm going to go back to the Berenstain Bears No Girls Allowed, where sister proved that she was really good at sports and activities. And whenever she used to pull something like this, where she showed everybody up, she used to make a big show about it.
Mm-hmm.
In that book, she learns that it's possible to be a bad winner.
Yes.
By crowing about your accomplishments and humiliating the other players. And in this book, it seems like she has learned that lesson and has internalized her pride. She's obviously very proud of being good at the game, but she's very calm about it and lets the sort of chaos develop around her. Mm-hmm. And I would also say that knowing these rules, it seems like to know a rule like that, you would have to be quick to react to that. Like, she would have to realize what happened and then take action.
Yes.
And that's a really, really good skill.
Yes, absolutely.
That not everyone's capable of doing.
Right. No. And, you know, if you ever watch a game, you know, part of the reason that you practice things for really anything, but in particular with sports, is to be able to recognize certain patterns and make the response second nature. And if you ever watch a baseball game, if a catcher drops a third strike, you know, that batter has to realize instantaneously pretty much that he can run to first. Because if you wait or hesitate, you know, a half second, the one thing that you always have to remember is the baseball is always going to travel faster than the person. So if you wait too long in that moment, the catcher might be able to get the ball and throw you out at first base if you're trying to get there anyway. So she, you know, Sister Bear has learned to, you know, make this kind of response immediate so that she can, I don't want to say take advantage of the rules, but show that she understands the game.
Yeah, yeah. I just think it's a nice subtle way to illustrate that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're running long here. So
yes.
We're going to cover this. And so long story short, they proclaimed that they weren't the best people at the best Cubs at the trials. They weren't the worst. The next day, the results get posted. Mama and Papa are sweating it. Like, they've been playing it cool, but it shows that they are just as nervous about this as the Cubs are. And the Cubs make the team. So you said there's four teams in the league, the Cardinals, the Blue Jays, the Orioles, and the Catbirds. And they both made the Cardinals. They made the same team.
Yes. I thought this was a little strange. Not that they were on the same team. I think a lot of youth sports leagues, if there's like little league within a town, we'll try to keep siblings together. The thing I thought was strange was that the four teams are the Cardinals, the Blue Jays, and the Orioles, which are all Major League Baseball teams, and the Catbirds,
which sounds like a minor league team.
They're, you know, minor league teams have some crazy names.
Yeah.
My favorite is the Montgomery Biscuits, which are they're a minor league team in Montgomery, Alabama, and their logo, you should Google it if you haven't seen it, is a anthropomorphized biscuit with a swatch of butter for a tongue.
It's amazing.
It's incredible. Now, minor league logos and team names have a lot of whimsy, but I don't know that I've ever heard of a team called the Catbirds. I suppose it's possible, but there is.
I'm going to assume that it's some kind of alternate Bear Country.
It must be
major league team,
because there is a Major League Baseball team called the Cubs, which would make a lot of sense, although I guess everybody would want to play for that team. It would be like if we, you know, in Bear Country, the equivalent for us would be if there was a team called, like, the New York Humans.
And, or the Children. It would be the Children.
Yes, the New York Children. You know what? That doesn't sound like the most intimidating team name on
No, I would say that calling any major team the Children I don't even know what your mascot would be. Just a child?
Yeah, just a little kid. But like a giant costume of a little kid that an adult has to wear.
Right. Or just like a man in a diaper.
Oh, God.
Or maybe one of those like Little Lord Fauntleroy outfits.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Hey, here come the Children.
Yeah. So I thought it was odd that they had the Catbirds and not, say, the Cubs. But now that we're talking this through, maybe they made the right creative decision.
Yeah. I think that's probably one of them alternate universe deals.
Yes.
So the first game comes up. They're up against the Blue Jays. Brother's up to bat. The pitcher winds up, throws a fastball. Brother watches it go by, and it gets called a strike.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are two things that I immediately thought of when I saw this. The first one is that when I was a little league umpire, as I've alluded to before, I was a home plate umpire several times, and calling balls and strikes is kind of hard because, you know, to get a strike in baseball, you don't just have to swing at the pitch and miss. If the ball is over the plate and between where the height of your knees and, you know, maybe the armpits or your chest, it's still a strike if the ball catches any of that area. And also, you know, to a certain degree, a lot of this is subjective. Every single umpire's strike zone is slightly different. And a catcher and a pitcher has kind of the job during the game of, to a certain degree, figuring out the strike zone that the umpire is calling and trying to work with that, as does the batter. I've been an umpire in this situation before where a parent has complained very vocally about my strike zone as I was calling the game. And and if you're a parent listening to this podcast and your children ever play Little League, I want to suggest that you never do that, because it is not only embarrassing for the parent to criticize like a teenager who's trying to make $20, but it's also probably wrong, because the other thing that this made me realize is that one of my favorite things when I go to a baseball game is watching everybody in the stands complain about the umpire's balls and strikes calls, because the odds are that you are sitting at a very off angle about 200 feet or more away from the batter's box. And if that's the case, you don't have nearly as good a perspective as the umpire. So how on earth could you know if it's a ball or a strike? You know?
When Mama gets furious.
Oh, yeah. She knows. She must have better vision than me, I guess. I'm not sure.
And it's Sister who talks her down.
Yes.
It says, Mama, please. Hissed Sister from the sideline. Now, even though the picture of Sister, she looks pretty cash about it.
Oh yeah,
to hiss something, please. Like, it's, well, you can tell her sister's embarrassed.
She has her hands on her hips, so maybe she's showing a little body language. But generally, she has what looks like kind of a smile on her face. She seems pretty relaxed.
It seems at odds with hissing. I'm going to imagine that Sister was probably a little embarrassed. As you said, it is embarrassing for everyone when a parent loses their cool.
Yes, over a baseball game played by, you know, 10-year-olds.
Yes, if that.
Yeah.
And she does. She cools out for the rest of the game. It doesn't even say, we don't even find out in this book who wins the game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at that level, maybe they're trying to teach you that at that level, it's more important to learn how to play than it is to win. Because you want to know how to do it right.
Right. That goes for the Cubs and the parents as well.
Oh, yeah. You know, when I played youth sports, until you get to high school, the goal is really to, you know, have a good time, but also learn how the game works and learn how to cooperate and, you know, participate with other people in a collaborative social situation. So I think that they're trying to show here that there are important life lessons to draw from youth sports beyond whether or not you won.
Right. And I think that's a great lesson to teach. You know, I didn't do sports as a kid. My oldest kid is 14 and did not do sports. But as I've gotten older, as I've witnessed my friends have kids and as I've talked to professional athletes in my own line of work, I've learned to appreciate the benefits that you get from the skills you acquire as a young athlete. Like you said, like the appreciation for teamwork, for learning rules and practicing something so well that you can think incredibly quickly on your feet. And the pride you feel from doing a good job, whether you win or not, like to learn to be a good winner, to learn to be a good loser.
Yeah, because you're going to win and lose throughout your life in many things. And it's not just going to be about a game you're playing. You know, you might, when you're 40, get that promotion that you really wanted that somebody else in the company was also going for. And you still have to be, you know, a respectful person regarding that. And those are lessons that you can, you know, draw from experiences dating all the way back to your childhood in sports and in other things. You know,
I'm happy to know that I have until I'm 40. So I have another month. If I can just if I can get that big promotion.
Yeah. When I was younger, I wanted to write my first book and have it published by the time I was 30. And that didn't happen. But
But if you stick to it like the Bears do.
Yeah. No, the Bears learned better than I did. And mom and dad, if you ever listen to this, that is not a statement on you. that is entirely about me. But, you know, if I had the work ethic that brother and sister Bear did, you know, I might be I might not just be your expert on sports. I might be your acclaimed author as a guest. Who knows?
So the Berenstain Bears go out for the team. I want to point out that in the on the cover of the book, you see it totally gives away the rest of the book. It shows the Cubs are on the team, like they're on the Cardinals, like they're wearing uniforms.
Yes,
they're ready to go. It's kind of a misleading image. It has like this hulking Bear as the pitcher and a terrified brother. Like it sets up a story that doesn't actually happen in this book. It's not about Brother Bear being scared to play baseball, which is what the...
I would say that the drama implicit in this image is definitely not actually there, especially since Sister Bear, too, in the background of that image, looks like this... Not only does she look helpless, but she looks way younger than she does in every other part.
Yeah. But cover aside, David Kalin, what did you think of the Berenstain Bears go out for the team? What did you think of it as a book that is being presented as a somewhat educational book for young people and their parents?
I thought it did a nice job of explaining, you know, several life lessons that we've kind of gone over here. But I actually think that, and this is the first time I've read a children's book in years, decades probably. I actually think that there's more in this book for the parents to learn than the kids, because the kids, if they go out for youth sports, they'll figure it out. They'll learn, you know, how to play the game. But a lot of those lessons about being respectful and responsible and about hard work, those are things that, you know, it's nice if the child has that innate work ethic, but those are lessons that they learn from a role model of sorts, and that comes from their parents. And, you know, Mama Bear and Papa Bear are, yeah, aside from the part where Mama Bear complains about balls and strikes and has to get talked down by her her daughter, which is pretty incongruent with their behavior for the rest of the book, you know, they do a pretty good job of nursing their children's latent interests without pushing them too hard to achieve them. And I think that that's an important thing for a parent to understand. And when you're a parent, and I'm not a parent yet, but there's no sign of that happening in the near future. But when you're a parent and you're reading these books to your children, I think that it's important for – and I think that the Berenstains probably maybe intended for this to be part of the story. It's important for the parent to take those lessons in as well as the child.
Well, I entirely agree. I'd say that probably 75% of the time the books are for the parents. They sort of teach you little – give you little clues as to like ways to raise your kids. And I'm going to totally agree with you on all those points. And I will say that this conversation has given me actually a deeper appreciation for the book, mostly for the actual character development, the things that I did not understand about the game and the things you pointed out, the nuances of the rules and the mechanics of the game showed me that these cubs are – They're bright. They are still learning. They're still growing. They're respectful kids. They are competitive and dedicated to their passions. And at this point in the continuity of Bear Country, I think that it's a big deal to point out for where the cubs are as characters. And Mama and Papa, they're learning the way their kids operate. They're learning to be parents who participate without overshadowing their own children's accomplishments. And they're all learning to be a family participating in an activity. And so from the deep in Bear Country perspective, I give the Berenstain Bears Go Out for the Team my seal of approval. I think it is a good book to have on any kid's storybook shelf. I don't have any problems with it like I've had with some of the other books.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, David Kalin, thank you so much for joining me this week.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about as I read this book was the pressure that these kids were under because they felt that, you know, there was a chance they may not make a team. And as somebody who did not make his freshman year high school baseball team, I was one of three people who were cut from the initial tryouts. And of those three, I was the only one who showed up every day and had all of his paperwork signed. But I don't worry, I've gotten over that in the 16 years since. I understand the kind of pressure that those cubs were under. And so I admire the cool headedness and, you know, the ice in their veins in those situations to achieve their goals. And I admire their parents for, you know, giving them just the right amount of push and the right amount of space to find their way as they explore and grow.
Fantastic. Well, David, where can our listeners find you?
They can find me on Twitter at David Kalin, DavidKalan. Occasionally I pop up on some podcasts here or there. And if you listen to The Flophouse, my brother's podcast, you might occasionally hear me complaining about something that he got wrong about sports, but hopefully not too much.
And as always, welcome. You can find us on Twitter at BStainBearcast. You can find us on Facebook at Deep in Bear Country. You can write to me at BerenstainBearcast@gmail.com. And you can also please rate and review us on iTunes. We would love to get some more ratings. So we'll be back next week with more Berenstain Bears fun. My name is Phil Gonzalez, and I will see you next week deep in Bear Country.